Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. My guest today is Eric San Juan, author of the book, The Films of Martin Scorsese, Gangsters, Greed, and Guilt, published in 2020 by Roman and Littlefield. Eric's book is an analysis of the 26 narrative movies directed by Scorsese, and Eric discusses his style and concepts, as well as presenting details about a number of individual films. Welcome, Eric San Juan. Hi, Eric. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to talk about your book, which is The Films of Martin Scorsese. He's had a long career, going back to 67 as far as feature films are concerned. But I think sometimes his career gets overshadowed a little by his crime and gangster films, which seem to be the ones that most people remember. In your book, you review all 26 of his narrative films, beginning with Who's That Knocking at My Door from 1967 through last year's The Irishman. But before we get into the films, I wanted to get some details about your background. You've written a number of books, including one on Kurosawa, and you've also co-written two books on Hitchcock. What led you to want to write about film?
I started off with a background in journalism. I still do some freelance journalism now, but prior to switching to the freelance world, I was both an on-the-street journalist and then in the office as an editor for about 15 years or so. So my initial interest came in just the my love of doing research and exploring topics that were of interest to me, and then finding ways to kind of distill what I discovered and bring them to other people. So at the time, in the early to mid 2000s, I was editor-in-chief for a now defunct DVD and film website, and one of the writers who I worked with, Jim McDevitt, and I had talked a lot, and he really had sort of started to immerse me in the world of Alfred Hitchcock. And of course, I very much fell in love, and we kind of brainstormed on this idea. I said, I think I might have a concept that would make not only good for a good series of weekly columns, but I think this might actually be a book. And so that's where our first book came from, A Year of Hitchcock, 52 Weeks with the Master of Suspense. Jim really brought to the table his expertise on the world of Alfred Hitchcock and the golden age of Hollywood cinema in general. And I kind of brought the writing and journalism aspect to it, and just kind of went from there. After doing that project, I felt that I wanted to explore this territory again. And so we revisited Hitchcock, and I visited Kurosawa, and my editor approached me after the Kurosawa book and said, what's next? And I said, I already knew the answer. I knew it was going to be Scorsese. And so he said, great, I'm a Scorsese fan. Let's do it.
It's funny. You said two things in your statement there. Number one, now defunct website. I suspect there's a lot of people who could use that. In fact, I can. Not one that I specifically founded, but one that I worked on. So did interviews
yes.
for. The other thing was that you mentioned you have a journalism background, and I've interviewed a number of people who have written books on film related, but are also with journalism backgrounds. And one of the things I always find that is so good with journalists is that they know how to get to the meat of a story. Nothing wrong with adding flour or adding extra details, but sometimes what you need is a punch. And Journalists seem to know how to do that.
I hope I was able to accomplish that. I mean, in doing work like this, it is an opportunity to indulge in the more subjective side of the work. Whereas when you're working as a journalist, you're trying to be as objective as you can. So hopefully that's, you know, I was able to walk that balance, but you know, it's an experiment every time you dive into a project like this.
So let's get into Martin Scorsese. What was the first film of his that you ever saw?
I would say it was probably Goodfellas, though I can't say that for sure. But Goodfellas was one of these pictures that I had on VHS shortly after it came out, and we just watched it on a loop. It's still one of these movies where you can tune in at any given point in it and watch it from there forward, and you'll enjoy it, or watch just 20 minutes and enjoy it. And that was very much how it was in my household. It was on all the time. If I had seen any other Scorsese pictures prior to that, I don't specifically remember. I might have seen Raging Bull at some point in the 80s, but I don't 100% recall. The first one where I had indelible memories of is certainly Goodfellas. That was a formative picture for me. That was one of the first films where I realized, like, oh, okay, this isn't just entertainment. There's something more here.
One of the ways that I knew of him myself was I was following film already. Of course, I think I'm a little older than you, but when Ebert and Siskel first appeared on public television and then eventually went to their own shows, and there was no question if a Martin Scorsese film came out, they were going to review it. And I definitely remember them discussing Raging Bull. And of course, at the time, what was so interesting to me, or what I found interesting, and was the fact that, you know, the fact that it was in black and white, the whole issue of Robert De Niro gaining and all that weight and then losing it again, and those kind of things made the film much more interesting to me, even though the topic of boxing or that kind of thing wasn't something that I particularly was interested in. I don't know when you started to get into your more film analysis, but what did you feel when you first saw Goodfellas or some of his more later films not too long after that? Did you immediately spot things that you could say, oh, I can see why he's different?
I don't know that I was immediately cognizant of what it was that made his work special, because initially when you see some of the pictures, at least the ones that he's best known for in mainstream consciousness, you know, there's a sort of almost music video-ish kinetic energy to it that draws you in on a very primal level. And Goodfellas has that, Casino has that, to some extent, maybe you could say Gangs of New York has that. And so that was what initially drew me in. I think what finally started to convince me a little bit, like let's say with Goodfellas, was this idea that, like, once you get a sense for the fine balance between attraction and repulsion when it comes to the characters. And I think that was something that I hadn't, if I had experienced it before in film, that this was really the first time where it came to the forefront, where I really noticed it, where you enjoy spending time with these horrible people, and yet the film makes no qualms, has no qualms about letting you know these are horrible people. You might enjoy spending time in their world, but it's a terrible world, and you really shouldn't revel in it. And so that was one of the first things that stood out to me. And then just as I started watching film more seriously and with adult eyes, you just start noticing the techniques that set him apart. You start realizing that a lot of the films that you had been watching were just very kind of pedestrian. They went through the motions. They were very standard as far as, you know, here's your medium shot, and here's, you know, just the techniques were, for most directors, are just pretty standard stuff. Whereas Scorsese, there's something that sets him apart.
Going into that a little bit more with his style, in your introduction, you talk about a number of concepts, specifically things like his use of anti-heroes, which, as you just pointed out, I mean, a lot of his films feature people who, you know, if you were walking down the street and saw them, you would definitely cross the street.
Right.
the fact that loudness and brashness are very important to a lot of his films, that he doesn't care about Hollywood convention and is willing to ignore it most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You point out a couple examples of where continuity doesn't even work for him. Sometimes he's perfectly willing to ignore obvious mistakes as long as he feels like the performances he got were better. What do you consider to be some of these aspects that you go into detail about that can be seen throughout his films, even the ones that aren't necessarily in the same vein as the ones most people know?
I mean, you certainly touched on a couple of them there. I think it's important to sort of note that while a lot of his films have kind of a loudness and a brashness to them, and that's very common throughout his work, even in pictures that aren't specifically about crime, Bringing Out the Dead, for instance, it very much has a similar style and technique as Goodfellas does, and yet it's a much different picture with much different themes. But there's just a high energy there. But I think it's also important to kind of note that it's not loud for its own sake. It's not in your face for its own sake. There's usually a purpose to it. He's not, I don't think he tends to be indulgent in that respect. He's indulgent in other ways, certainly, but not in that respect. And I don't think he does it just for the sake of doing it. I'm losing the word that I'm searching for here, but he's not, I'll skip that. But when it comes to the violence and the profanity and so on, I rarely get a sense from him that he's doing it just because he can or just to shock the audience. And I think that's really important in his work. Some of the other stuff is just his whirlwind camera and very much the kind of needle drop soundtrack that he often has in his pictures. His use of music is not just impeccable, but it influenced an entire generation of filmmakers to come. And as somebody who grew up in a household where music was basically playing 24 hours a day, where music is a huge, huge part of day-to-day life, having music woven so firmly into the fabric of his pictures really, really stood out to me. I mean, his song choices and when he would drop them, that kind of stuff, just nobody was really doing that until he came along and showed us how to do it well. I mean, those are, you know, just a couple of sort of the technical things that stand out to me. And, you know, then of course you get into the themes, and that's a whole other topic.
What is interesting with me and his films, and even to his present films, is that a lot of his films, he does not find the need to have a real quote unquote soundtrack. He doesn't. A lot of the films don't have regular soundtrack music, which was not unusual given when he started. There was a lot of situations where soundtracks during the 60s, late 60s and early 70s where and into the 70s where soundtracks were not necessarily as important as they've since become. Again, obviously they were more important in the past, but the fact that he still to this day, and Irishman is a perfect example, where he just wants to just put various songs and he's going to use those songs. And while some writer or some filmmakers may put songs on just to fill in the spaces until they get to the composing, he uses them because I'm going to guess that's what he was thinking of at the time that he was working on a scene.
Yeah, I really get the sense from him that when it comes to his music selections, he's not choosing them because, you know, just because the song is great and he wants people to hear it, or because he wants people to say, oh, I know that one. There's often a real sense of purpose in his choices. And sometimes it's purely a matter of mood. But sometimes there's a little more subtlety in there. I think Casino is a really great example of that, where a lot of his song choices, if you pay close attention to the lyrical content of the songs, they're commenting on the picture. Right there in the midst of the film, there's some commentary there. And I think he's probably just as knowledgeable with music as he is with film. And that's saying quite a bit. So when he makes a choice, you should probably, you know, prick up your ears and pay attention, because he's making that choice for a reason.
Of course, even though it's not the subject of your book, He's also a very accomplished documentarian, and many of his documentaries are music-related. He's done a couple with Dylan. He's done a Rolling Stones one. He did The Last Waltz famously. He worked on Woodstock, even though he wasn't the director. So clearly his musical background is there.
Absolutely. And for anyone listening who isn't aware of his background when it comes to being a documentary filmmaker, I mean, I think you would agree, right? Highly recommend to check out his work, because he's just as good a documentary maker as he is a feature filmmaker. I really wanted to include that aspect of his work in this book, but just for length, I couldn't do both and do the feature films justice.
Well, that's the thing. He's written so many. I mean, he's been involved in so many films over the years. I mean, 26 films over, 53 years. At first glance, basically sounds like one every other year, which it sort of looks that way if you look at the dates of his various films. But all the other ones that were in the same time, he was doing documentaries in the middle of them. I mean, it was not unusual to see that. But so let's start talking about some of the films. Obviously, with 26 of them, we could talk about any of them, and I'm sure we will talk about quite a few of them. But I'd like to feature a few. And the first one I want to talk about is Bassett in his early period. And by that, I mean his first film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, was in 67, was basically a continuation or a buildup of his work, his student work. So you sort of look at that film and say, that's not really a Martin Scorsese. I mean, it is, but it's not the same going forward. But his early period, he's got Mean Streets and Taxi Driver. And if you want to talk about starting off with a bang, so to speak, those two films, I think, goes a long way to showing that. But in the middle of the two, he does Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore,
mm-hmm.
which most, if you told somebody about Alice Doesn't, anybody that knows that film probably knows he directed it, because otherwise they're not even thinking about the film. But it's definitely in stark contrast to the other two. But what stands out to you about that film, particularly as it relates to his early style?
There are two things that really stand out. One is the fact that it's a very rare Scorsese picture with a female lead, and that is prominently focused on issues that are concerning the life of a woman. He's had great female leads or co-leads throughout his career, and I think he gets knocked a little bit for not having great woman characters. When in fact, I mean, I think seven, maybe eight. Please don't quote me on that, but a great number of his leading ladies have had Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress nominations. Certainly, he's given women great roles, but this is one of the few pictures where the woman is the center of the picture. But the other thing that stands out, and that you wouldn't expect given what I just said there, is that the Scorsese style is still here. It's still present, and it's quite visible. You just wouldn't imagine it in this kind of picture, which, really concerns a woman's journey into finding herself and learning to live on her own without her husband and developing her relationship with her son as a single woman. And yet there are scenes of that sort of very visceral, very difficult to watch violence, particularly with Harvey Keitel's character. There are wonderful scenes where he uses music to great effect. There's that sort of very gritty, grounded realism, sort of hyper realism almost there, that you wouldn't expect in this picture given what the subject matter is.
One of the strangest aspects of that film is the fact that it later became a television show, a comedy television
yes.
show called Alice, and it's almost like if we use comic book terms, that they're two different planets on a multiverse, because there's little, if anything, other than the character and her basic concept and the fact that she worked in a diner that compares the two. So it is just so funny that something like it's sort of I wouldn't want to use the comparison to MASH, given that the MASH television show in many ways was even greater than the film, but I think it still makes for an interesting comparison.
It certainly does. And I love your comic book comparison there. I think it's very, very apt. Yeah, it's strange to see a Scorsese picture reinterpreted in that way. Now, granted, this wasn't a picture that he wrote. It was one that was brought to him. But still, it was brought to him for a reason, though. You know, they wanted his sensibility after having seen Mean Streets, which came out the year prior. So, you know, this might not be a Scorsese concept, but I think still at its heart, it's a Scorsese picture.
Speaking of that, and this was going to lead into as we continue, is that his willingness to take mainstream film jobs so that he can work on the ones that those that he considers more meaningful. Gave me an example there, although I would not ever consider Alice Doesn't Live Here anymore to be a quote unquote mainstream film at its core. But that's not unusual, because obviously Scorsese was coming up at the same time of people like Francis Ford Coppola, who frankly famously has done the same thing, where he took films that he didn't really care that much about just so that he could get work doing the ones he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a lot of people, partly because of the independent film streak that was coming up during this period. So how does The Color of Money, which he made right before The Last Temptation of Christ, fit into that concept of doing a mainstream film so you can do the films you want?
I think if when it comes to that particular topic, I think you can probably make the case that maybe outside of Hugo, it's the definitive example of Scorsese going mainstream for the sake of continuing his career. He certainly did with Cape Fear as well, and Cape Fear was a huge success. But with Cape Fear, I think he managed to twist the movie he was initially given enough to make it his. The Color of Money, there's not that much. There's some Scorsese in there, and I think he drew on some of his experience growing up in New York and being on the streets of New York and being in pool houses. He's very comfortable in that environment. You know, there's that great fight scene in Mean Streets that takes place in a dingy pool hall. But yeah, The Color of Money was really about the star power. It's about, you know, bringing Paul Newman to life and this rising star, Tom Cruise, who some people may have heard of. and I think it was very much made with the audience in mind, more so than many of his pictures are. There's still some great techniques going on there, you know, especially in the scenes of Tom Cruise playing pool. He uses a lot of, I think in the book, I liken it a little bit to his approach with the boxing scenes in Raging Bull. There's kind of a hyper realism about it. You know, they're though it feels very real, it isn't. You know, when you see Raging Bull, those boxing scenes, that's not how boxing plays out. And that's okay, because that's not the intent. But yeah, this picture is, I remember this one from when I was younger as well. In fact, I may have seen this prior to seeing Goodfellas. Because I remember some years later learning that Scorsese had directed it. And I was like, are you sure about that?
You get that sometimes with some of his films. You have to think about it for a minute. He did? You know, that kind of thing. You don't remember, unless you've watched them multiple times, it's very easy to forget that. You know, especially nowadays, where he's been typecast so poorly with the quote-unquote kind of films he makes, that a film like that would fall through the cracks a little bit.
Right. Yeah, and I think the other really interesting thing about The Color of Money, and the thing that makes it so unusual in his filmography, is, of course, that it's a sequel to a very beloved picture from 1959, The Hustler, with Newman and Jackie Gleason. And again, that's not the sort of thing that we now expect from Martin Scorsese. I guess at the time in the 1980s, when his career was kind of in flux and it wasn't clear that he was going to become the legendary director that, say, Roger Ebert always predicted that he would be, maybe it wasn't as surprising for him to do something like this, but in retrospect, it certainly stands out.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I want to mention Last Temptation of Christ, given that that was the film that came out next and clearly was a labor of, I guess, love. We can use that for him. It was an important film for him to make. In your introduction, you talk a lot about his, and in some of the other books, or some of the other films, you talk a lot about his being raised Roman Catholic, even though obviously he didn't live or doesn't live a Roman Catholic life. What aspects of that background of his were so important for The Last Temptation of Christ?
I think there are a few things there. Certainly, Scorsese himself, I think, has always lived with this sense of unspecified guilt hanging over him, which a lot of people very much associate with Catholicism. And Scorsese himself would say that. And you sense that in a lot of his pictures. And I think that was something that he kind of needed to explore here. And I think he wanted to explore his own relationship with Jesus Christ. I think he had sort of uncertain or unsteady feelings about what it really meant to be a man of faith and what it really meant to be a Catholic. And though he, as you rightly point out, he hasn't necessarily lived his life by Catholic ideals, he still considers himself a man of faith. And so, you know, I think this picture was really him wanting to dive into his own feelings and his own relationship with his faith. Which is why I think he made the interesting choice to interpret Jesus as a man. Okay, you know, what would Jesus's experience and his time on earth be like if it was seen through the eyes of him being a mortal man, a human man? And so sort of that's kind of the thrust of the picture, and it's one of the reasons why, of course, it became so controversial, because this is a very human, very grounded, very flawed Jesus of Nazareth. But I think that's what Scorsese wanted to see. He wanted to see, like, okay, but who was Jesus as a man? Not as this sort of deified, untouchable figure, but who was he really as a man? Because he was both.
Of course, it's interesting that this whole concept, and the film came out in 89, so you would think by that point this concept wouldn't be completely foreign. I mean, to a large extent, the infamous or famous rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar was built around the same concept of trying to look at Christ more as a man than as a god, so to speak. But obviously I have to assume that, or whether he was completely surprised by all the controversy, or he just assumed that Last Temptation of Christ was not going to be a film that was going to open easily.
Yeah, I think he was also somewhat a victim of his times. I think had this film been made 10 or 15 years prior, it might have received a different reception. But coming in 1988 and being made throughout on and off kind of throughout the mid 80s, which was a time when there was a renewed conservatism in the United States. We're in the midst of the Reagan era, and through things like, there was the Satanic Panic and so on. So there was this new focus on these issues and this sort of idea once again that you must tread very carefully when dealing with and talking about, you know, sort of religious icons and religious figures, like like Jesus. So
of course, we were at the rise of the Christian right as well during this period, because it was Reagan who really was the first to reach out to evangelicals as a voting bloc.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. So it's, you know, you make a great point when you mention Jesus Christ Superstar, which had come the decade prior. And I can't help but wonder that had Last Temptation come out in the 70s, if it wouldn't have been received much differently, not only because of because it would have fit a little more with that era, but it's also a much more 70s feeling picture as far as its groundedness and its grittiness and its very kind of rough and low budget nature.
So, of course, now we're talking about, this is through 1989, and for any filmmaker, that alone would be a great career.
And yet, in
1990, he goes completely onto his next phase. And this is the truth. The first gangster movie he made was in 1990, and that was Goodfellas. Prior to that, he did a lot of things with bad people who were quote-unquote bad or had their issues. But the first time he actually looked at a gangster was in Goodfellas. And definitely one of the greatest crime films compared favorably to The Godfather. In fact, many people, if you look at errors, Godfather was the crime film of the 70s, and of course, Goodfellas was the crime film of the 90s, although he then, of course, tried to top himself more than once. He follows the book very closely in the movie, which is interesting because I know his movies are often based on books. The question is, how often does he follow them carefully? But having just reread Wise Guys, the book Goodfellas is based on, and then watching the film, he does follow it very closely. There's very few times where he gets that far away from it. And yet, he's careful about that. So, for example, since the film and the book are supposed to be from Henry Hill's point of view, he doesn't show any of the actual Lufthansa heist because Hill wasn't involved in it. We only get it from Hill's point of view when he finds out it happened.
A fascinating choice, really. I mean, that's an incredible choice. You know, you typically want to show the major events on screen, but yeah, as you point out, this is Henry's movie, so of course you don't see it.
So, what about Goodfellas? What were there differences in the way he made Goodfellas versus his earlier films, or what did he build on or create new that affected him going forward?
I think one of the things that really signified a shift in style for Scorsese with Goodfellas is he threw out the door the whole idea of needing to have an attention span for one. You know, this is less of a 2 hour and 20 minute full narrative as it is a series of short vignettes about Henry Hill's life. I mean, it's very rapid fire. You can pluck out 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes out of the picture and sort of have a mini semi-complete story there, because it's about a series of moments more than it is the full arc of his life. And you know, it was very much of the era. I think he himself has even cited the notion of having a music video approach to it. So it's, you know, bang, 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 very rapid fire. You had mentioned earlier his disregard for continuity, which I touch on in the book, and we see it as early as Who's That Knocking at My Door. But here again, it really pops up here, where it doesn't matter what characters are doing from take to take, as long as he has the performance that he wants. You know, I think in watching this picture when I was younger, one of the first things that I had always noticed was the appearing and disappearing cigar that Paulie has in one scene. And I said, oh boy, that's a mistake. They made a mistake there. It wasn't until later I came to learn that. Now, I'm sure that he was well aware of that. He just didn't care, because it's not about that kind of thing. This is definitely the sort of the turning point of his career, though. I mean, as you say, it's the start of a new era for him. And that lack of concern for an attention span, you know, is certainly a part of that. There really isn't anything in this picture despite the fact that it is his most famous one-er in his career, the famous Copacabana shot, there's really not anything in this picture that demands you sit down and really take in and ponder what you're seeing. There's not a slowness to it. There's not a deliberate pace to it, such as what you get in the non-boxing scenes in Raging Bull, for instance. It's just nonstop. The energy is relentless.
You talk about continuity errors, and speaking of crime films, the one that always gets me, and I'm sure it's me more than anybody else, is early on in The Godfather, when Marlon Brando's talking to Nazarene the baker, and Nazarene has his cigar in one hand. And then the next shot, he's shaking hands, doing a double shake hands with Marlon Brando.
Yes.
And what happened to the cigar? And suddenly it's in his mouth. So obviously Coppola didn't care about that. He figured, what the heck, we don't have to actually see him put the cigar in his mouth so he could shake his hands. But it's one of those little things that, unfortunately, this is what happens when you watch a film too many times in a row. Often you tend to spot those things. So obviously, Goodfellas, one of the most striking things about it, obviously, is this use of narration. And of course, from this point on, it's pretty regular in many of his films. Plus also his willingness to break the fourth wall and have characters talk directly to the camera.
Yeah, I think Taxi Driver probably stands out as a little more prominent in that regard, just because it wasn't used as much in Taxi Driver, but it's just as important to the narrative there, because in Taxi Driver, that, you know, the narration really helps you get into De Niro's mind. But Goodfellas is where I think he kind of fully threw out the rules and said, you know what, narration works for me and I know how to use it well and I can use it to great effect. So I'm going to start using it all the time now, despite the fact that it's frequently frowned upon. You know, the Taxi Driver might have been a little bit of an anomaly in that regard. But yeah, but Goodfellas came along and he finally just said, no, you know what, this is a great technique, and I'm going to use it. He even breaks the rules of narration in Goodfellas by having a second narrator pop in partway through the film when, you know, Karen.
But what's interesting about that is that's exactly the way the book's written. Most of it's mm-hmm. through Henry Hill, but every once in a while we get Karen's point of view in the book. So it, in a sense, you're right, it's unusual, but it makes sense, especially if you're familiar with the book.
I think it really helps that he and Nicholas Pileggi worked side by side in developing this screenplay, because, you know, of course, you know, Pileggi wrote Wise Guy and then worked on the film as well with Scorsese. So it's, you know, boy, it doesn't get much more from the source from that, right?
Mm-hmm. And some directors are very good about ignoring the writer, even the original source material. But as I said before, I do feel like Scorsese felt there was enough in the real life stuff that we didn't want to just ignore it, or we don't have to build on it or over-dramatize it, because there's a lot of drama there already.
Absolutely. And you know, you touch on something really important that I think is really noteworthy. You know, as you say, a lot of directors make it a habit of ignoring the, you know, the writer and taking the source material and making it their own and so on. But Scorsese not only doesn't tend to do that, or if he does, it's very much in service of the themes and the story that he's trying to tell. But I think most importantly, one of the things that we see here with his work with Pileggi, and it carries through with his work with his actors, he's very much a collaborative creator. You know, we look at him as a creator with a singular vision, similar to Kurosawa and Hitchcock and Tarantino and many others. But and while he is a creator with a singular vision, he's a collaborator. He's very much a collaborator. I think that's one of the things that makes his work so interesting, is that he really affords the people he works with the ability to bring something to the table. And then it's just really his vision of picking out what works and what doesn't and fitting that into his overall tapestry.
Of course, that's probably one of the reasons he, like a lot of great directors, likes working with the same people. He feels like, these are people who I can collaborate with. And I mean, Pileggi's involved with a lot of his later films. Obviously, many of the actors appear for the first time in early on. I mean, De Niro is the obvious one, but then in later times, people like DiCaprio and others, Harvey Keitel, for example, regularly appears in his films. And I think this probably goes back to that concept of these are people who he knows he can collaborate with.
Absolutely. He's some directors, again, Alfred Hitchcock is a great example. Alfred Hitchcock famously planned out his films in such meticulous detail that he often found the process of directing them boring. He didn't enjoy directing the pictures because, as far as he was concerned, he had already made the picture in his mind. He knew exactly what it was going to look like when it was done, and all he needed was for the actors to get up there and go through the motions, and you know, and that was that. But Scorsese, he likes to get hands-on on set. He likes to invent on set. He's in love with that process of being on set and figuring things out and that kind of thing. And it's probably caused problems for him because he's often had budget issues with his pictures, you know, and he's had problems securing money over the years and pictures going, you know, over budget and that sort of thing. He's not really known as the kind of guy who brings his movies in on time and on budget, but you can't really argue with the results.
We were talking about the narration part, and I'm shocked. I mean, you can tell you it's been a long time since I've seen Taxi Driver, which is unfortunate, but that I'd forgotten that had a narrator. But I know, really, with Goodfellas, he really takes it to the next level, including, famously, the casino narrators. Once again, we have a dual narrator, but what's more interesting to me was the fact we didn't know till the end of the film which of the two was actually dead. Because you got a narrator who's dead, or you think so, right at the beginning in Robert De Niro's character. When, as it turns out, it's Joe Pesci who ends up dying in the film. So, and yet he's also narrator. So obviously Scorsese doesn't even care whether the person's alive or dead if he wants to use them as a narrator.
Absolutely. And amazingly, Pesci's character dies while narrating the picture, which is a remarkable choice. It actually does not make any bit of sense when you think about it, but it sort of doesn't matter. He has that kind of disregard for the rules of what you expect that it kind of doesn't matter. It's shocking the very first time you see it, and you know you're listening to Pesci's character Nicky, you know, discuss what's going on, and right there in the midst of his narration, he gets bopped over the head with a bat. It's a shocking moment. There's almost a degree of ridiculousness and absurdity to it, yet the violence is so horrible, and it comes out of the blue that the absurdity works. There's a dark humor, and yet it's all very serious and ugly. He blends these things so effortlessly. It's amazing that it works sometimes.
I want to go sort of left field here now, because we've mostly talked about films that most people probably, as we've said, oh yeah, that's Martin Scorsese, except for the occasional ones. I want to look at Kundun, because completely different from anything he's done. And I want you to talk a little bit, I mean, because most people probably aren't even going to know, number one, what the film is, or worse, maybe know it, but didn't know Scorsese was involved in it. Talk about Kundun. Give me some background, or give your listeners background so they get a better sense as to what Kundun was, because it clearly qualifies as a passion project for him.
Very much so. And I'm really glad that this is the one that you chose, because this is one of those pictures where when I'm trying to express to people that Martin Scorsese is not the stereotype that you think of him as, you know, he's not just Goodfellas and Casino and those kind of pictures. He actually has a very eclectic body of work. This is one of the ones that I like to point to, because it's such a different picture, and yet it is still very much a Scorsese. So Kundun deals with the life of the Dalai Lama, the current living Dalai Lama, specifically his life from around 1937 to 1959. It deals with the Dalai Lama as a child when they were first searching for the new Dalai Lama, him being brought into his position, and then the events that caused him to have to flee Tibet with, you know, the conflict between Tibet and China. He fled Tibet and go, you know, and went to India and went into hiding and essentially has not been back to his home country ever since 1959. And it's a very deliberate, very slow, very meditative, very beautiful picture. It's not the kind of approach that people associate with Martin Scorsese's work, and yet it still is very much his work. It takes its time getting to where it needs to go. It doesn't mind luxuriating in just pure imagery. It's very much a spiritual picture. It's part of what you might consider his trilogy of pictures that are concerned with faith and men of faith and religious figures. You know, The Last Temptation being the other one, which we spoke about, and Silence, his 2016 film that barely anybody saw. That's also concerned with similar issues. All three beautiful pictures in their own right. But this is one that is especially interesting because, of course, it has nothing to do with Christianity or Catholicism. It's very much outside of his wheelhouse in that regard. But I think there are themes enough and ideas enough in it that are meaningful to him that he's able to tap into that. He actually has a similar approach as he does in Last Temptation, where the Dalai Lama is a holy figure. He's and yet Scorsese looks at him as a human being. He looks at him as a genuine human, with all that implies. And I think that makes it a little more powerful to me to see him in that regard.
And of course, he was careful to use Asian actors. I mean, this is he did not compromise with when he made the film.
No, absolutely not. These are not just Asian actors, but you know, people from Tibet and actual Buddhists and amateurs almost across the board. Most of these, including the children, who were surprisingly wonderful in their roles, were not professional actors. He had a lot of amateurs that he brought in for this, and that's tough to do because sometimes it can lend an air of authenticity, but sometimes it can also bring a picture down because people who can't act. But the choices were very good here. The casting was excellent because I think the cast was generally uniformly quite excellent here. And you're right in he was really careful about having this sense of authenticity, including with the imagery that he uses, which he doesn't explicitly go into it in the picture, but there's imagery of this sand art that is connected with the beliefs that he deals with in this picture. And he uses this sand art throughout the picture, not only just to kind of visually bring you into this world and connect you with this world, but it's also kind of speaking to the fleeting nature of what's happening here and the sense of loss that the people of Tibet and the Dalai Lama in particular are experiencing. It's powerful stuff, and I really highly recommend it to people. Even if you're not a Scorsese fan, I think for you know it's a very dreamy, beautiful picture. I think it's one of his best, and it's sorely overlooked.
Well, that's one of the things. It's easy to point to the big ones, you know, the bombastic ones, and we've talked about some of them. But it's the other ones too that I think he deserves credit for, because it does show that he's got range as a director. It's easy to say, oh, well, all of his films are about gangsters, all of his films are full of violence, all of his films are loud, and that's not true. And so talking about a film like this is important to understanding his overall work.
Absolutely. And you know, you had mentioned before about him not often using traditional Hollywood scores, and that's generally the case in most of his pictures, and it's kind of the case here, but he sort of uses a traditional score, but he makes an interesting choice that works really well in having Philip Glass compose the music for it. And so it's a very soft and somber and repetitive kind of score, very much un-Scorsese in that regard. And there's a sequence towards the end where I think it's about 11 straight minutes of this repetitive building Philip Glass work on the score that is it's mesmerizing, just mesmerizing. And it builds this sense of tension and drama in a way that you typically don't get from Scorsese's work, because he tends to have that kind of needle drop, you know, radio station approach. But he doesn't do that here. And the choice was impeccably made because it just works so well.
So now let's get to The Irishman.
There we go.
Which made a major splash when it debuted on Netflix last year. Got Academy Award nominations and everything. Obviously, one of the first things people said about it was that it was incredibly long, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I consider it transfixing. I've watched it twice now, and both times first time I split up. I sort of took a break. The second time I had the time, and I literally watched it from beginning to end with no break. So I clearly found it transfixing. Do you think, or did you see, in a sense, that this might be the culmination of his crime films?
I think rather than it being the culmination to his crime films, I think it's more of an answer to his crime films. It's kind of, I think there's a degree of this being him and De Niro, and to a lesser extent, Pesci, who had to be convinced to star in it, and you know, Keitel, looking back on their careers through this guy, through Frank Sheeran. I think this is Scorsese looking back on his career and reassessing it. More so than taking everything that they learned previously and applying it to this one last great epic. I think this is very much some older men looking back on their careers and looking at what they did and what they accomplished in a different light. I think that's the whole point of the last 45 minutes or so of the movie, which has come under some criticism. I think there's a lot of viewers who find that last stretch of the picture boring. I'm not one of them. I'm with you. I saw it for the first time in the theater. I went up to Manhattan to see it and saw it a few more times on Netflix. And, you know, that last stretch of the picture is really what the film is all about in my eyes. It's very much this idea of Frank Sheeran, and through Frank Sheeran, De Niro and Scorsese looking back and kind of assessing their career and seeing it through different eyes, seeing it through the eyes of an older man. In Sheeran's case, of course, he's looking at it through some very empty, very dead eyes and understanding that he wasted a great deal of his life. I don't think that's what Scorsese's trying to tell us. I don't think Scorsese considers his past work a waste, but I think there is a sense of kind of assessment there where through this picture, he's trying to understand the things that he did in his past and the impact that this had on him as a man now and on his family, on his relationship with people. Because he's had some very turbulent relationships over the course of his career. Not so in recent years, to be fair to Mr. Scorsese. He's been in a great relationship for many years and, you know, and so on. But early on in his career, he had many ups and downs in that regard. So, you know, I would call this more of an answer to his pictures, more so to his previous crime films, as opposed to a culmination of it. If that makes sense. I don't know if it does.
Although it's funny. I mean, this is where the answers are. I swear he uses the exact same shot as Jerry Vale that he used in Casino in this film.
I believe you're right. And he does reuse a little bit of music here and there. What's the one he reuses? One of the ones from Goodfellas, and I'm blanking out on the name right now. But he reuses a few songs. There's some of those kind of callbacks that you see here and there. I think he wanted to some extent wink and nod to his previous pictures, but as they said even prior to the picture coming out, you know, if people are expecting another Goodfellas, that's not what this is, and the people who are most disappointed in it seem to be the ones who wanted that. Though I have seen also a lot of critics who say they didn't care for it because it was just another Goodfellas. And that I just don't understand where they're coming from at all.
No, I mean, I think the key is that he made a conscious attempt in the last part of the film to show that for all the quote-unquote success Sheeran had, in the end, he lost so much more, and his life becomes a, you know, somebody who depends on, who needs help from other people because he can't do it himself anymore because he's so old. And I think to use the term denouement for that last 45 minutes of just the ending of his life and how, you know, he's constantly trying to make up for what he did wrong, even trying, you know, getting involved in religion and everything like that. And yet in the end, he's still unwilling to tell the FBI agents what happened in the
right.
end when they come to interview him. He still has that in his mind that he's just not going to say. And then once again, using the book as an example, there are a number of points in the book where, you know, the author says that he is not willing to say anything that portrays a confidence. He just never is. And until he feels like he, number one, has permission, or it's not going to make any difference anymore because everybody involved is dead. Unlike some of his other films, at the end, nothing's left. Everybody's either been arrested or in jail or died. And it clearly shows that the life was not necessarily one that was well lived.
Absolutely. And I think this is yet another example and possibly the final great example of a Scorsese protagonist who brings his own downfall upon himself. This is something that we see again and again in his pictures. And Frank Sheeran certainly is one of these guys where, you know, he lives out the last days of his life, an empty man, a lonely man, even as his family doesn't want any contact with him, you know, his surviving daughters. And it's his fault. You want to pity him, yet at the same time, having just seen him do, you know, almost 3 hours of horrific things, it's hard to muster up that pity. And I don't think Scorsese demands pity of us. I think he wants us to understand that, you know, Frank did this to himself. It was not a life well led. He led an ugly life, and these are the results of that life. And much like Jake LaMotta and Henry Hill and so many other characters, his downfall was through his own choices. Somebody else from the outside didn't do it to him. He did it to himself.
Speaking of Henry Hill, I think, to me, this is where I found Irishman to be more authentic with the end. Not that Henry Hill didn't he went into witness protection, which theoretically, at least he's still living. But if you know anything at all about Henry Hill up until afterwards and into his death, he had a terrible life going forward. He started to, he broke out of witness protection, went through marriage, went through divorce, got himself into all kinds of other kinds of trouble. Clearly somebody who, at the end of the film, you think, okay, of course it was 1990, so some of these things weren't even, you know, it had just happened not that far before. We didn't get the downfall, complete downfall from him, where I suspect, in a way, in Irishman, we wanted to make sure we got the full downfall.
That's a great point. And the parallels there are definitely quite stark, because yeah, Henry Hill's post witness protection program life wasn't particularly good. And even though he was, a regular on talk radio shows and all that, and he kind of became a minor
call
celebrity.
Call into Howard Stern all the time. I used to remember hearing him call in, and it's like, you know, it was weird.
I think he came across as one of these guys who people were laughing at him and not with him. You know, people weren't necessarily on board with him. He was more of a train wreck than anything else.
Yeah, because if you look at Goodfellas, how many times does he actually kill somebody?
Yeah, that's right. I don't believe he does at all.
Right. And I mean, the only time I can think of is at the beginning when they're in the trunk, but he's just standing back. He's not involved in it. He's just watching. He gets involved maybe a little bit in some of the beating stuff, but it's interesting. And that's what he always said, even later on in life, is that he says he never killed anybody. Well, I appreciate your time, Eric. I think the book is a great overview. I think one review called it, rather than a criticism, it's more of an analysis, which I think is true. But it does, you know, you're not somebody who ignores fault. You just have found the positives and the kinds of various things that are most useful in his filmmaking. And I hope either you or someone else does a similar review of his documentaries, because I think they deserve the same kind of treatment that you did in this book.
I agree.
So once again, thank you for talking with me, and I hope everyone goes out and reads your book and uses it as a reason to go back and rewatch or watch for the first time some of these films that either one, they didn't know Scorsese made, or two, forgot, and they get a chance to see them again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed my time with you, and you know, love to do it again one time. Who knows what my next project will be? Maybe we'll talk for that.
I've had multiple guests. I've had guests appear more than one time because they continue to write. So nothing wrong with that. So
fantastic.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
My thanks to Eric San Juan. I hope his book gives you a greater sense of one of the great American filmmakers. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.